Welcome to the Social Flight Live podcast, an audio version of our live show, hosted every Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. Eastern at socialflightlive.com. Social Flight is brought to you by Aspen Avionics, Avidyne, Bose Aviation, Continental Aerospace Technologies, Lightspeed Aviation, Massimo MightySat, Tempest Aero Group, and Whip Air. And now, here's your host, Jeff Simon.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Social Flight Live. I'm Jeff Simon. We have a really important show for you tonight. On September 3rd, the FAA released a legal interpretation of the Federal Aviation Regulations that completely upends how supervision is done at maintenance facilities, threatening everything from maintenance's workforce, AMP training, owner maintenance, all sorts of things that are extremely critical to all of us. Mike Bush is here, and I'll be joining him in a conversation about what this means to you and what you can do to help, which is an absolutely critical part of what we're going to be doing moving forward in order to try to fix this. Before we get started, just a few things. First of all, things are booming in Social Flight. We want to be sure that you get there, check it out, and get out there and flying. We have tens of thousands of aviation events, destinations, amazing cool things going on. Please go, completely free, supported by the folks on the board behind me, to socialflight.com or the free Social Flight mobile app for Apple and Android devices. Again, all of these events, all these destinations, our mission is to support general aviation and get you out there and flying with a fun mission of your own to go do something fun, especially with all this fall flying. And we're seeing so many cool things coming in. I just love surfing it just to see these pumpkin drops and pie-ins and crazy events that are happening all over the place. It's very cool. Be sure to check that out. We also have just launched our Destination Digest, new destinations feature in there that has like thousands of curated destinations with photos and ratings if there's crew cars available. So much going on. Be sure to check all that out. And it also sends you out an email with all these destinations near you so you can see what's new and what's happening in your area. And lastly, we have the Fly to Win Challenge going on. We just gave away an Aspen E5 electronic flight display. October 1st, we are giving away a Lightspeed Delta Zulu headset. All you need to do is get on the app, check in, and you can win. You get points for doing that. It is very, very cool and a great way to participate in general aviation and hopefully win something for yourself as well. We're always giving stuff away. Tonight's broadcast is brought to us by Phillips 66 lubricants, including the Phillips 66 XC20W50 multi-weight oil that I fly behind and absolutely love using. It's been fantastic for me and my engine. And in addition to that, of course, they have their Victory line of oils, their anti-wear with anti-wear additives, their anti-rust oil, hydraulic fluids, and so much more. And look for some great education coming to Social Flight soon from Phillips 66 that'll teach you all about a lot of this and engine maintenance. Those courses are available within Social Flight. It's our learning center. If you want to get WINGS credits or get IAA credit, your IAA renewal and their certificates, you can do all that for free within Social Flight. Just go to Social Flight, click on the FAA credit section. You are gonna see all the courses you need, and it's all automatic credit from the FAA, and will help you with either your WINGS, your AMT awards program, or your IAA credits. Now, to tonight's guest. Mike Bush is arguably the best known airframe and power plant mechanic in general aviation. He founded Savvy Aviation in 2008 to provide aircraft maintenance management and consulting services to thousands of aircraft owners, including pre-buy management, innovative engine monitor analysis, and 24/7 breakdown assistance that is essentially AAA for GA. In addition to that, of course, he has authored hundreds of articles and 4 books on aviation ownership and maintenance. Now, Mike and I have been working hard on the back end behind the scenes since this interpretation came out from the FAA to build awareness and to organize a response to this new FAA legal interpretation. So let's dive into it. Please welcome to Social Flight Live, Mike Bush.
Good evening, Jeff.
How are you, sir?
Well, I'm all charged up. I had a wonderful weekend spent getting ready to fight with the FAA, which is something I enjoy doing more than anything I can think of, other than flying, maybe.
Yeah, it must be that either our hands have been on a keyboard since this came out, or our phones have been glued to our ear, talking to everyone you can imagine, trying to
Yeah.
deal this. So I want to
Both at
dive
the same time, actually.
Yes, at the same time. I want to dive into this, but I would like to start by asking if you would give everyone a baseline on a couple things. The first is how maintenance actually works in the real world, how shops operate in a way that people may not understand, and how supervision plays a role in that. Can you explain that to everybody?
Sure. Well, I'll try. If you go into pretty much any repair station or maintenance shop, and this is true whether it's a five-man GA shop or whether it's Boeing or and everything in between, you will find that some of the people who are wrenching on airplanes are not A&Ps. Now, actually, in repair stations, some of them hold what's called a repairman certificate, which is sort of a junior A&P that in a way. But many of them are totally uncertificated, have no mechanic certificate whatsoever. And actually, most of those guys are there because they're working on their to get their A&P. And in order to get an A&P to qualify to take the test to become an A&P, you have to either go to a Part 147 school, which is like a couple of years of full-time schooling, or you need to be an apprentice mechanic for 30 months for the A&P. And so the and even if you go to Part 147 school, part of that schooling is apprenticeship. So if we didn't have uncertificated people working on airplanes, we wouldn't have any A&Ps because that's the only way you get there. Some aircraft owners are shocked to learn that somebody working on their airplane when they put it in the shop might not be an A&P, but that's just a necessary part of the process. And so there's a regulation that provides for uncertificated mechanics, mechanic trainees, mechanic apprentices, whatever you want to call them, to work on certificated airplanes as long as they're doing it under supervision of a certificated mechanic.
Right,
And that's
right.
what this whole interpretation thing was all about.
And so this is the way that things operate no matter what. And you know the check and balance at the end, right, is that these people who are either not certified for that particular type thing or not certified at all at that point, or an owner or whoever's there, they're not returning something to service. They're not inspecting it at the end. They're not making the logbook entries in the inspection.
Right.
So it's
Right.
not
A,
like
a, an
it's a free for all.
uncertificated mechanic is allowed to perform maintenance under supervision. He's not allowed to approve maintenance. It's actually two separate regulations. There's a regulation called 43.3, which talks about who's allowed to perform maintenance. And then there's 43.5, which talks about who's allowed to approve maintenance.
Right. So, and when we talk about setting this baseline, so we've set this baseline for how what happens. And of course, like you said, owners could be in the shop, trainees could be in the shop, any all sorts of things under supervision. Now, for a second, before we get it,
How'd your son Jake get his A&P?
the same way I did through the experience, through the
Of
apprenticeship.
course.
Right.
And do you think there's probably not an A&P mechanic alive, or at least anybody's been an A&P more than a couple of years, who hasn't been in the role of supervising an apprentice.
Absolutely. And you're only authorized to do the work that you've been trained on anyway. So how do you get trained? There's all sorts of permutations of it. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
The other thing I would like you to explain to everyone before we really dive in here as a baseline understanding is the difference between the federal aviation regulations and then what happens when those regulations get interpreted by FAA attorneys and you get something like this letter or like the COLEA letter that you like, that we all like.
Yeah.
That, you know,
yeah.
Can you explain that process and then we'll dive right in?
Yeah, I've been involved with the FAA lawyers on lots of interpretations over the years. I've asked for a number of them. I've responded to a number of them. But
right.
It's an important part of the process. But basically, we all have these regulations that we know and love, which we used to call the FARs, and now we call 14 CFR. And these things were written by lawyers, and some of them are pretty obvious what they mean. Some of them are a little inscrutable because they were written by lawyers. And once in a while, a situation comes up where somebody wants to go to the FAA and say, hey, I've been puzzling over this regulation and I need help in deciphering what it means, usually in the context of some particular situation. And so there's a process for doing that. You basically write a letter to all the lawyers in the FAA report to the Office of Chief Counsel. It used to be called the Office of General Counsel. Now it's the Office of Chief Counsel. And under the Chief Counsel, there's what used to be called the Rulemaking Division. Now it's called the Regulation Law Division. FAA keeps changing names in their org chart. I don't know why they do that. But there's an assistant chief counsel for regulation who at the moment is a lady by the name of Laura Megan Posh, who is the assistant chief counsel for regulation. In FAA speak, she's AGC 200. And if you're puzzled about a regulation, you write a letter to Miss AGC 200. And you pose your question. And then you hope for an answer. It used to be you'd get an answer in 3 or 4 months. This latest one came back in 26 months. I don't know why it took so long. But and sometimes you don't get an answer at all. That's another subject. But I've submitted requests for interpretation. And then finally, after a couple of years, spoken to the lawyer to whom it was assigned, saying, Mike, I'm sorry. You're not going to get an answer to that one. It's too much of a hot potato. But hopefully you get an answer, and then that answer that you get, which is typically in the form of a letter or in this particular case a memorandum, is a precedent setting. And actually, the FAA maintains a database of these things that you can access online and search by keywords and stuff. And they represent the official agency position on what a particular regulation or a particular part of a regulation means. So when you ask for an interpretation, that interpretation becomes binding on everybody.
And that's the key, right? That's what we're about to talk about tonight. What matters here is that just what you said, we've got the Federal Aviation Regulations or CFR, 14 CFR, and now we're about to talk about an interpretation that all FISDOs, all enforcement agencies, everyone associated with the FAA will be looking to as their interpretation. Is that correct?
Unless we convince the FAA to take it back.
Until we fix it,
right.
All right, so let's
One way to think of these things is asking for a legal interpretation from the FAA is kind of like asking for a revenue ruling from the IRS. You say, hey, you know, I've been puzzling over this obscure piece of the revenue code. I can't quite figure out how it applies to me in this situation. You pose a question, and then theoretically you'll get a revenue ruling back from the IRS, and those things are published, and they become you know, binding on everybody.
Yep. All right. Let's tell the story. So why don't you tell the story here about what, tell us all about what this case is that has both of us and everybody else up in arms.
Wrapped around the axle.
Oh God,
a couple times. Yeah. Well, you know, I actually don't know the entire backstory. I'll tell what I do know is that about 26 months ago in May of 2022, I guess, a gentleman by the name of Jonathan Moss, who happens to be the manager of the Little Rock, Arkansas FISDO, wrote a letter to Ms. Megan Posh, AGC 200, asking for an interpretation of a regulation of 43.3, actually a part of that regulation, 43.3, subparagraph D. 43.3 is the regulation that talks about who is allowed to perform maintenance on certificated aircraft. 43.3, subparagraph D, is the part that talks about uncertificated people performing maintenance on certificated aircraft under supervision of a certificated mechanic. And basically the question, and I think we'll want to dig into this reg a little bit closer, but basically the question that Jonathan Moss posed was, the regulation says that the supervisor must personally observe the work. And Jonathan Moss was asking, what does personally observe the work mean in the 21st century, where every human being on the planet is carrying a high resolution camera that is networked to every other human being on the planet at the speed of light? What does that mean? What personally observe? Can you use a borescope? Can you use a smartphone? Can you use a closed circuit TV camera? Can you use, you know, videos? And
can you be remote? Can you call?
Can it be remote? Can it be electronic? You know, what does that mean? I mean, because this regulation was written 60 years ago, and it has, and we're going to look at the regulation, but it's a regulation that was written 60 years ago. It's actually older than that, really, because it came from the predecessor, the CAR3 regulation, that was pretty much the same language. But this regulation hasn't changed in 60 years. And the guys who wrote it 60 years ago couldn't possibly have visualized the world we live in today, where everybody's networked together and everybody has, you know, high resolution cameras in their pocket and stuff. So his question was a legitimate question, which was, you know, how do we interpret this requirement to personally observe the work in the 21st century?
And this is the actual regulation that they were referring to and asking for that interpretation, so for everybody to kind of see there. A person working under supervision, holder of mechanic or repairman certificate, may perform the maintenance, preventive maintenance, and alterations that a supervisor is authorized to perform. If the supervisor personally observes the work being done to the extent necessary to ensure it's being done properly, and if the supervisor is readily available in person for consultation, however, and then it goes into a section that says you cannot inspect. But that's the regulation.
So let's talk about this and how we in the industry have understood this, what this regulation to mean, for the past 60 years until this memorandum came along.
Until days ago.
So it basically is saying that a person working under supervision doesn't have to have a certificate. Doesn't have to be a pilot, doesn't have to be a mechanic, only has to have a pulse, okay? It's a person working under supervision of a mechanic may do whatever work his supervisor is authorized to do other than inspections, other than required inspections. An uncertificated person cannot do an annual or 100-hour, but except for inspections, he can do whatever his supervisor is allowed to do under two conditions. The first condition, which I will call condition A, they aren't labeled in the reg. It's a big run-on sentence, but if we bust it up into pieces, the first condition is the supervisor personally observes the work to the extent necessary to ensure that it is being done properly. And this, the second condition, which I'll call condition B, is that the supervisor is readily available in person for consultation. So as we have understood this in the industry for the last 60 years or more, the first condition, the supervisor personally observes the work, is the proactive obligation of the supervisor, that he is required to personally observe the work to the extent necessary to make him satisfied that the work is being done properly. The second condition, which I'll call condition B, which talks about readily available in person for consultation, is the reactive responsibility of the supervisor to be available to the person being supervised, the trainee, if the trainee has a question or gets stuck on something. Yep. Or, you know, just generally feels like he's getting in over his head and he needs some help. That's what the second part is about. The trainee has to be able to holler to his supervisor and say, hey, I need you to answer a question. I need your help on something. Right. So there's this proactive part of it and there's reactive part of it. And if you think about it, you read this thing over and over again. I've read it about 300 times in the last 3 days. It is just like very, very, it's just a very common sense set of rules that
yes.
And everybody has been satisfied with it. And everybody has been pretty sure that they knew pretty much what it meant. For the 60 years since this rule was written into the FARs.
Right. And I want to add there real quick that the extent necessary seems to be kind of everything, like, because every situation's different, right? We can't write a rule for everything. Every situation's different. It could be drilling out rivets and like, I'm going to show you how to drill out a rivet. Here's a couple of them. Now you drill out a couple rivets. Great. Now go do 100 of them. I'm going to go do something else and then I'll come back and inspect it. See, or come grab me if you need me. Or it could be different steps in a process that's really critical where it's like, you're okay for this step. I need to be here for that step. It could be all sorts of different things, but it's up to the mechanic. And this is how we do things day one. So what happens and next?
The example I used in my letter to the FAA had to do with changing a cylinder. And I use that example because changing a cylinder on a reciprocating engine is as close to open heart surgery as anything we do in maintenance. Okay. So the question was, how would you supervise changing a cylinder to the extent necessary to ensure that the work is being done properly? Well, I don't know about you, but I would, first of all, not a whole lot of supervision is required during the removal of the cylinder because it's kind of hard to screw up and it's pretty obvious how you do it. You know, you unfasten everything and get everything out of the way that's in the way and then you pull the cylinder off. You know, I can see some questions coming up if somebody gets stuck or if somebody, you know, can't get an exhaust nut to come loose or something. But basically, it's pretty obvious. Probably the only part of that process that I might want to be involved in as a supervisor is maybe removal of the piston pin, because sometimes those things are a little tricky to get going and you don't want to put excessive side load on the connecting rod and stuff. But pretty much there's not much supervision required in the removal of the cylinder.
And also the installation of this. Also want to add real quick, it depends on the people, right? Sometimes you have someone that's their first time.
Well,
sometimes
I was
you have
get
someone
to
that never went to their AMP. They never got their AMP, but they've been in your shop for 10 years.
Yeah. So, you know, the installation of the cylinder, you probably want to watch pretty closely when as they're installing the rings on the piston to make sure that the stack up is correct and to make sure that the end gaps are within spec and all that stuff. And then you want to watch like a hawk when they're torquing the hold down nuts and the through bolts, because that's the part where people cause catastrophic engine failures when they don't do it exactly right. It's highly critical.
Right.
And then you probably want to finally take one more look after the job's completely done to make sure all the baffles are in place and the spark plug leads aren't chafing and all of that final stuff. But and as you said, that's what you'd want to do the first time you supervise a trainee on a cylinder change. The 100th time you supervise them on a cylinder change, and you reached a point where you think he pretty well gets it, you're not going to need to supervise him nearly as closely, because he's pretty well trained, and he's 26 months into his 30 months of experience to get his own A&P certificate. So anyway, when you look at this regulation, there are some key phrases that jump out at you. The first one is personally observes the work. What does that mean? And that's really the question that Jonathan Moss asked. What does personally observe the work mean in the 21st century? That's a legitimate question, I think. There was some ambiguity there because the reg was written 60 years ago, and we live in a pretty different world. So it's kind of like, well, if we could bring those guys who wrote the original reg back 60 years later and say, what do you what would you what did you really mean by that in the current world? It would be really interesting to hear their answer.
Right.
But that's really the question that he asked. The second thing that jumps out is to the extent required to ensure it is being done properly. And that I think has always been interpreted as being pretty unambiguous, and it gives the supervisor broad discretion to determine how much supervision is necessary. And keep in mind that the supervisor has a very powerful incentive to provide an adequate amount of supervision because it's the supervisor that has to approve the work. It's the supervisor whose name and certificate number are going to be on the logbook entry that approves the aircraft to return to service. And if the work isn't done properly and something bad happens, it's the supervisor that's going to be on the hook either for, a certificate action or being or a, civil damages for negligence or both, that it's so supervisors have a very powerful incentive to provide adequate supervision, but the regulation has always been interpreted to give the supervisor broad discretion as to what adequate is in any particular case. And like you said, there's so much variability here. You can't write a reg that says what adequate is. It's got to be a judgment call.
So everybody's in suspense. Let's get into the meat of it of what the FAA answered, what their interpretation was.
Well, it was a long 3-page memorandum, and it was a memorandum rather than a letter because it was going internally to an FAA person. And this was a case where it wasn't a civilian that asked for the interpretation. It was an FAA guy, the head
Right.
of the FISDA.
Well,
So
we don't know, but probably for an enforcement action.
that would be my guess. Why would he ask that? We're
Yes.
just speculating because I don't know why Jonathan
I'm
asked
only
these questions.
speculating also, but you don't ask if
I've sort of asked myself this question for years, but I thought better of asking the FAA because, I'd rather not have this interpretation be done
You
at
wouldn't
all.
want
But
this to be called the Bush memorandum?
exactly, yeah, the Bush interpretation, right? So there are some Bush interpretations if you look at the database, but I didn't want this to be one of those.
All right. So let me read this because we have people on podcast also and audio only. Their first part of their answer, and there was two critical parts. The first part, the Office of the Chief Counsel finds that the phrase in person explicitly requires physical presence. Virtual presence through a live video feed or other technological means cannot replace the physical presence of a supervising mechanic. And I will let everyone know, this isn't even the big bomb. This is the first part.
This is the first part, and it's just dumb. Okay, it's if this were the only thing that were in this interpretation, we probably would not be talking about it on Social Flight Live, and I probably wouldn't have been spending the last 4 or 5 days of my life, you know, with a call to arms. But it's pretty dumb. And the reason it's dumb is because he is saying that the phrase in person requires physical presence. Well, nobody ever questioned that in person requires physical presence, but the phrase in person only appears in condition B.
Right. That's only,
which means if the trainee says, "Hey boss, come over here. I need to show you something." You need to be, you know, readily available to come over and look. Okay. But that's not the question that Jonathan Moss asked. Jonathan Moss asked about the proactive part of supervision and whether that could be done remotely. And the phrase in person doesn't appear in condition A of the regulation. What it says is personally observes. So Moss was asking, what does personally observe mean? And the lawyer who wrote this memo was answering, here's what in person means. Well,
right.
Nobody ever questioned that in person meant physical presence, but that was only if the trainee asks for the physical presence.
And let me give an example of this, because I think it's important to put this in like perspective. It could be you as an owner working on something for your annual, and they say, like, you know, drop the exhaust, whatever, I'm heading out to the parts store, or I'll be right back, or whatever they're doing. And they were trying to say, is it okay? Like they're sort of answering here, like, you can't like FaceTime him and say, I can't get this nut off. What should I do? You know, or show him something where, you know, when he's not there, they're saying, nope, in person's in person. That's their part of things.
Well, and I don't think anybody has ever questioned for the past 60 years that if a trainee needs the supervisor to come over and help him with something, that the supervisor is obligated to go over and help him with something. That's never been in question. And that's not what Jonathan Moss asked about. Okay.
Right.
It's just total. But you know, this thing that you've highlighted in yellow, the dumb part of the interpretation, as opposed to the catastrophic part of the interpretation, which we'll get to next, I guess. It's conflating condition A and condition B. It's interpreting a phrase out of condition B as if it were part of condition A. The condition A is the proactive obligation of the supervisor to ensure that the work is being done properly. And condition B, which is the part that talks about in person, has to do with responding to trainees' requests for consultation.
So let's get to the second one there so we can really dig in. And I'll read it first again. The second part that was the real bomb here is the phrase readily available in person for consultation contemplates a physical hands-on approach to supervision. The certified mechanic must be available not just to answer questions, but to notice mistakes and take over if necessary. This is no way in line with the way that we operate.
Right. This is the part of that's catastrophic and that has caused us to get all worked up about this, because first of all, readily available in person for consultation is the reactive part. But again, this lawyer has transmogrified it into being a proactive thing that says, if you read the second sentence on the highlighted sentence, it's basically saying the mechanic has to be in physical proximity from start to finish, spring loaded to intervene anytime he sees something going awry. Yep. Which would basically mean that the that for an uncertificated person to work on an aircraft, a certificated mechanic would have to dedicate full time to watching him.
Yeah, one-on-one, and not even taking your eyes off it. Not if the whole point
exactly.
is to notice mistakes and take over.
And it's an interventionist requirement, which was never part of this regulation. So I mean, this is the part of the interpretation that has got us totally worked up, because if this standard of having to be physically present from start to finish and prepared to intervene at any point in the process, if that interpretation were to stand, it would be economically infeasible for any shop to allow an uncertificated mechanic to do any work,
or an owner,
or an owner. There wouldn't. I think there probably would be an end to owner assisted annuals. It would certainly be an end to owner perform maintenance that was done under supervision. I mean, the vast majority of work that's done under supervision, and you know, there are some exceptions like the cylinder case I mentioned, which is very highly supercritical kind of thing. But most work that's done under supervision, the supervision consists of, okay, go ahead and call me when you're done so I can inspect your work.
Right.
Not all work is done that way, but the vast majority is done that way. There are certain kinds of work where the inspector has to look before the finishing touches are done, because the finishing touches kind of close up the thing where you can't inspect it anymore. But the supervision, the amount of supervision required to ensure that the work is being done properly is normally a very short amount of supervision in terms of the total time that the job requires.
Yeah, I mean, literally, you can't step away. You can't, if it's like, hey, you know, I got to go to the bathroom, it's like, don't do anything till I get back.
Yeah.
Like, you can't do it. It's economically completely infeasible to do. And this is the direction that the FISDOs have been given at this point.
Yep.
It's an enormous challenge. And, you know, one thing occurred to me, I'm curious about your thoughts on it. This came about, they only did this because they were asked, obviously. And part of it is us being outraged and wondering, like, what in the world was this person thinking? It seems almost, I've been pounding, like you, like we've read this 300 times. We've all been in 1,500 conversations about it. The only thing that I can come up with, and I'm dying to hear what you think of this, this seems like the attorney's office at the FAA is taking the same approach to maintenance, not understanding maintenance, as we do in the cockpit. Because that's what flight training is about, right? Flight training, you have to monitor every single thing that happens and intervene. You cannot tolerate any error of any kind. You have to be able, or if there are errors or there is, it has to always be observed to the point that it has to be intervened. It's all about intervene. Whereas
Jeff,
in maintenance, it's about getting something back.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but even in flight training, I believe there's this concept of solo flight where trainees are actually allowed to do stuff on their own.
You are absolutely right, my friend. Absolutely, absolutely right. I stand corrected. But still, it's that concept that you can't allow a mistake to happen. Whereas way I think of it is, even though it is not something that really I think happens, in theory, that example I gave of drill out the wrecks, the next 80 rivets. If the supervising mechanic comes back and this person elongated 16 holes, it's now that doesn't mean it gets returned to service substandard. It's now the shop's fault, the shop's responsibility. The shop's got to replace the part or do whatever repairs necessary. Whatever they've got to do, it doesn't get back into the air until it's right. And there's no risk. No airplane's crashing because it wasn't caught immediately, like this says, not just to answer questions, but to notice mistakes and take over if necessary.
Yeah, I was saying to you before we started here, one way to think about supervising a trainee is the supervisor is responsible for the proper execution of the work. The trainee is a tool. It's like a screwdriver. If the work is not done correctly, you don't blame the screwdriver. You know, you blame the person who is wielding the screwdriver. If the work a trainee does is not done properly, the trainee is not the person who's being held responsible for that or for the consequences of that. It's the supervisor. And the work is not completed until the supervisor says it's completed and signs his name to a 43-9 maintenance record entry, attesting that the work was done satisfactorily.
Yeah,
and which is something a trainee can't do. A trainee can't approve work. He can only do stuff, but he can't approve it.
Yeah.
Do we have 5 minutes to have a little fun with Blakey versus Sugden?
Yes, please go ahead.
To put a sharp point on how badly this interpretation was done, after doing this crazy interpretation of this rule that everybody has understood what it meant for 60 years, and this lawyer just sort of went ahead and turned it on its head.
And they cited
he cited in support of his interpretation of his crazy interpretation a case called Blakey v. Sugden, which was an enforcement case, I think back in like 2004 or something. I forget the date, but something like that. But the case that he cited was a case of where the FAA suspended the commercial pilot certificate of a professional pilot for 75 days. The pilot appealed the suspension. It was heard by an NTSB administrative law judge who upheld the FAA suspension. The pilot then appealed it to the full NTSB, and the full NTSB also upheld the suspension. And that's what this case that was cited was about. Well, it turns out what Blakey v. Sugden was about, Mr. Sugden, his airplane was in an avionics shop and having some avionics work done. And the avionics shop was running behind schedule. And this pilot was worried that he was not going to get his airplane back in time to make some missions that he was supposed to fly. So he decided he's going to go down to the avionics shop and help out. And he wound up taking it upon himself to reinstall the radome on this airplane, which was presumably a piston twin of some sort. And then he proceeded to go fly the airplane. The problem was that he flew the airplane without obtaining a sign off from the avionics shop on the work they did. So he was flying it without an approval for return to service. So his violation wasn't a violation of 43.3. It was a violation of 91.405, which is about operation after maintenance. That basically says after an airplane undergoes maintenance, you can't fly it again until certain things happen. And the most important thing that has to happen is that there has to be an approval for return to service by an authorized person, which in this case would have been somebody at the avionics shop. But he didn't wait for that to happen. He just went and flew the airplane, and that's why they busted him. Now, it was also argued that he installed the radome without supervision. It wasn't right. A question of whether he was supervised to the extent necessary. He wasn't supervised at all. He didn't ask for supervision. He didn't get any supervision. He just did it, you know.
He was now, just like, I need to get my plane out of here. I'm just going to do this myself, right. Roll the plane out, and get out of here.
Now, if I had been Mr. Sugden's defense lawyer, which fortunately I was not, I would have argued that installing the radome was actually preventive maintenance because it's a fairing, right? And installing a fairing is something that an owner pilot or an owner operator is allowed to do if he's pilot rated, except that he would have had to make a logbook entry approving it for return to service. But that really wouldn't totally work because the avionics shop had done some work on the airplane before he installed the radome, and they never signed that work off. Okay, so he wasn't allowed to fly the airplane. And that has nothing to do with 43.3. That's a 91.405 violation, and the guy they busted the guy dead to rights, and everybody agreed that he was righteously busted for doing
and,
that.
And the key there, I think, in why the story is crazy is that that's their justification for saying
for this crazy interpretation.
Right. That is their case. That they as to why they think that you have to supervise full time, be there to notice mistakes and take over if necessary. So where do we go from
this,
here?
Let me cap this off by quoting the final sentence of this 9-page letter that I just sent today to the Ms. Megan Posh, AGC 200. It was actually not a 9-page letter. It's a 7-page letter with 2 pages worth of signatures on it. Because once I wrote the letter and I ran it by a whole bunch of directors of maintenance and owners of shops and stuff, every one of them said, I want to sign onto that letter. So it had a lot of signatures besides mine.
I want to point out before you read that to everybody is that many, many groups, like you mentioned, many shops, many folks, many other lawyers involved in the profession. We have all, this isn't the Mike Bush and Jeff Simon show of like having interpreted this. Everyone reads this letter as being a massive, massive change.
We've now contacted and gotten full support from the general counsels of AOPA.
Yep.
Of GAMA, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, of ARSA, the Aeronautical Repair Station Association, of AEA, the Aeronautical Electronics Association, literally everybody, and a lot of aviation attorneys have looked at this and said, "What were they thinking?"
I spent Thursday on the phone with Mark Baker. We are all, everybody is, the good news is everybody is up in arms. The next question is, where do we go from here? So Mike, why don't you explain to people, because this is the standard today. This isn't like a, hey guys, there's a notice of rulemaking. Like this isn't an NPRM. This is where it is today. So where do we go from here?
Well, I mean, it's a good question. I did what I could do, which is to write this long formal letter requesting reconsideration and send it to AGC 200 via email and registered mail today. However, the normal turnaround on that sort of thing is measured in months and frequently months in two digits.
This one took 20 something months?
They inexplicably took 26 months to respond to Jonathan Moss's request. And what were they doing for those 26 months? Well, I'll tell you what they weren't doing. The lawyers at the regulation law division were not coordinating this with the maintenance division in the FAA, where there are people who actually understand what happens in maintenance and, you know, all of that stuff, because it would have never seen the light of day had they properly coordinated it. Best we can tell, a young lawyer wrote this thing and nobody really proofread it very carefully, and it just got issued. I'm sure the powers that be at the FAA did not intend this to happen. I think it happened sort of without proper oversight. And so this is a subject that I have been told will be brought up in a number of meetings at 800 Independence Avenue in the next couple of weeks. And hopefully we can get something more expeditious than a 26-month response time.
Yes, there's a meeting happening at NBAA, I'm told, as well, which I'll be mm-hmm. there. And our goal is to hop on this as much as possible. But I think it is very important.
Because if taken literally, it will just be crippling to the industry. It really will.
Yeah. And I think this is something I mentioned at the beginning of the show. This is important because not only do all of you in attendance tonight and those who watch the recording, et cetera, need to know about this and what it means. But this is one of those, like, send it up the chain. Contact everyone that matters in order to exert pressure on that. To all the alphabet groups, to the FAA themselves, to anyone that will listen, we need to have an industry response to this, and we need to have people know about it and care about it in order to affect change.
And, you know, I think in fairness to the friendlies, you know, these legal interpretations come out with some frequency. Many times a year, and most of them are sensible. This one is a huge outlier. This is just something that should never have been issued, and it was just a mistake, and it's got to get corrected.
Mike, can you repeat your last line of your letter?
Oh yeah, the last line of my letter, which I can't take full credit for, because a very, very experienced aviation lawyer helped me out with this one, says, we believe that the September 3rd Moss interpretation of 14 CFR 43.3D represents an arbitrary and capricious reinterpretation of a universally accepted, well-settled, long-standing industry practice, and is therefore impermissible under the Administrative Procedures Act without a formal rulemaking action, including notice and comment, which is basically saying you're not allowed to change the rules in the middle of the game without going through the full rulemaking process that involves putting out an NPRM, getting industry comments, considering the industry comments and stuff. This was not an interpretation. This was a rule change, disguised as interpretation. And there's nobody in the industry that believes that 43.3D means what this interpretation says it means. This is just way, way outside the lines.
Yeah. For those people who are looking to search on
this. Am I sounding passionate yet?
you and I both, my friend. For those people looking for this, until you will see it, we both Mike and I have articles coming up. Other people have it, so you're going to see it. But if you want to do your own search out there, Moss, M-O-S-S, we are looking for the Moss FAA memorandum regarding 14 CFR 43.3. And then I believe you can find it that way when you search underneath that. Is there a better means that you're aware of, or will you have it posted to your site at Savvy?
Actually, we will have both the interpretation memo and the and my diatribe against it added to the Savvy website within the next day or two, and we'll be sending an email blast out to the 35,000 aviators that are on my mailing list, giving them links to it so that everybody can enjoy this stuff as much as we have.
Yeah, and I want to encourage people, actually, when we're talking about this, we've focused on the biggest part that affects us. We focused on the big bomb that was part two of this, about being readily available and having to have constant supervision in there. But, you know, I'll be honest, as long as this is now kind of an open issue to be addressed by the FAA, as long as they've made it critical enough that we have to address this, I do believe that it is important that we also reconsider the first part, because we are in an age of electronic communications, YouTube and, well, not YouTube, but, you know, all the electronic means of being able to supervise and use Zoom and other things and FaceTime. And the fact is, the FAA does this, right? They do this today. And I don't mean this in an accusatory way. I mean it in a way that they accept it. They use it for their own inspections. They use it for their own types of things. They have their own remote technology guidelines for how they use remote technology to do all of these things. And they even include deviations as to when they can even deviate from those rules. And so I think we should not only be like pushing back on the part we feel is outrageous, but that we should be able to move to an environment where some parts of this, where appropriate and where deemed necessary, as it says, by the supervisor, can be done that way. What are your thoughts on that, Mike?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, it's the first part, the less objectionable part. That's what Jonathan Moss asked about in the first place. Okay. And, you know, most of us weren't going to ask that question, but now that it's been asked and answered badly, it really ought to get answered properly, in a way that is in harmony with all the other things that are going on in the FAA that are encouraging the use of electronic technologies to do things remotely that we were never able to do remotely before. So, I think it does deserve a thoughtful answer. An answer by somebody who really understands the maintenance.
And I think one of the interesting things also is there are parallels here in medicine. There's parallels in medicine. There's parallels in surgeries, the surgical part of medicine. This isn't like this has never been tackled before, whether it be supervision, all these other things. Other places have gone through this in very, very, very life critical ways, mm-hmm. and not had these arbitrary things, these arbitrary rulings. And so we should be able, the big part is we should be able to get through this, right?
Yeah. And you know, as I argued in my letter, I said, if the wise men who wrote this regulation 60 years ago were wise enough to give supervisors broad discretion to determine how much supervision was necessary to ensure the work was done properly, those same wise men surely would have given the supervisor discretion to determine how the supervision needs to be done to ensure that the work is done properly. You know,
someone
wrote
it.
It doesn't make sense to take that discretion away.
Absolutely. Someone wrote in. I rarely mention things, but this one's a good one. They even have remote towers, right, with video feeds. Excellent point. Credit to you. Boy. Well, Mike.
Are we having fun yet, Kip?
Yes. Well, Mike, I want to say thank you for taking time out of your evening, especially on short notice, to join us here on Social Flight Live for this. I want to thank everyone else that joined us to be able to see this. This is really important stuff. So stay tuned. You will see stuff, of course, in articles and all sorts of stuff from Mike. You'll see stuff from me. You'll see stuff from all the Alphabet groups. We're on this for all of us.
Full court press.
What's that?
A full court press.
This is the, in probably my whole career, this may have been the biggest full court press I have seen in the shortest amount of time. So, Mike, thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to join us here on Social Flight Live and helping everyone understand this. And again, for those of you out there, Savvy, go check it out. Savvy Aviation is such a wonderful resource to help reduce your maintenance costs, get you, take care of you when you're on the road and you're away from home and you have a breakdown. I'm telling you, you can save so much money through Savvy.
We're maintenance advocates for aircraft owners, and what we're doing tonight is part of our advocacy.
Absolutely. So, Mike, thank you so much for joining us tonight on Social Flight Live.
You bet, Jeff. It was a pleasure. Enjoyed it.
Have a good evening.
Okay.
Thanks. And thank you for everything that all of you do to support General Aviation and for your help as we move forward in this effort to get these rules changed. I really do appreciate it. Again, you will see much more through Social Flight. Please check out socialflight.com. We'll be back next Tuesday, October 1st, with Jimmy Graham, NFL former tight end pilot and Young Eagles chairman. Boy, is that going to be a lot of fun to have Jimmy here on the show. So I'm very excited for that. We're then off for NBAA and then back on, we're then back on October 15th with JJ Friggy from CEO of Hartzell Propeller. And so again, thank you all so much for taking time to join us. And I wish you all blue skies.